So we're going to cover hopefully a lot of ground this year. You know, we did like two shiurim to cover Parak Aleph and two shiurim for Parak Beis. I want to do Parak Hey and Vav. Hopefully we'll do two prakim in one shiur. We should be able to do it pretty quickly because these prakim really are very different from everything else in Sefer Shmuel. All of Sefer Shmuel is dominated by the few key personalities: Eli and Chana, Shmuel and Shaul, David, Yehonasan, Yoav, Avshalom. The one exception is these two prakim, where the Navi takes basically a step out of what's going on with Bnei Yisrael, because we follow the Arum. We learned the last couple of weeks about the catastrophe at the Battle of Afek, where Klal Yisrael lose, the sons of Eli are killed, Shiloh and the Mishkan are destroyed, and the Aron Kodesh was captured. So Prakim Hey and Vav kind of leave what's going on with Bnei Yisrael and follow the Aron who was captured and taken to Plishti territory. So I don't have as much to add to these prakim as what we've done the last few weeks. So I think we should be able to go through it more quickly. A couple of critical points, but we'll be able to cover a lot of ground. And then hopefully next week we'll begin with Parak Zion, which is the parak of Shmuel's leadership. I think that's going to be very exciting. So load up the screen share. I think it's going to be helpful to have. Just one second. Okay, here we go. What did I just do? This one second. I'm going to fix that. Because that is way too small. Sorry. There we go. Okay. All right. Title for this week's shiur: Hashem saves the Aron. Now, on one hand, it's a nice, uplifting parak, but others will think there's definitely a darker side to it. So first thing the Navi tells us is the Aron's been captured. The Plishtim take the Aron. Plishtim lachu es Aron elokim. They bring it from Evan HaEzer. Evan HaEzer, that was the site of the battle. That's where Bnei Yisrael had camped. So Bnei Yisrael ran away. So now the Plishtim are in Evan HaEzer. So they captured the Aron. That's what it means over here. They captured it. They bring it to Ashdod. Ashdod, city on the coast, one of the five main Plishti cities. In a little bit, we'll look at a map to see all five. What do they do with the Aron? Very interestingly, they bring it to the house of Dagon, or the temple of Dagon. And they present it next to Dagon. So, right, we can picture the scene. They've captured the Aron. Remember, the Plishtim, when the Aron was first brought to the Jewish camp, they panicked, because they think of the Aron essentially as the physical manifestation of the Jewish God, right? There's our gods and there are the Jewish gods. So they recognize the Aron as a real religious object, right? And they think of it in Avodah Zarah terminology as something that has godly value, right? They think that the Jewish God has been defeated by their God. That's why they think they won the battle. So on the one hand, they still venerate it, so they're going to bring it to their temple. On the other hand, it's a highly symbolic moment, because they're stating, you know, that by capturing the Aron and bringing it to Dagon, so we're declaring Dagon's superiority over the Aron. Right? If it was the reverse, so obviously we would not recognize any divinity to Dagon. Dagon is just some god that was, you know, made up. The Plishtim recognize that there is divinity, right? They think of the Plishti god and the Jewish god, and the Plishti god won. So now we have the Jewish god in our temple, right? And similar to how you have when a king defeats other kings. So the way he'll demonstrate his superiority is you'll bring the captured king, right, to your capital city, and Nebuchadnezzar has all of his captured kings who are with him, So that's essentially what the Plishtim are doing here with the Arum. So a couple of points, though, to think about already as the Perek introduces us to this scene of the Arum being placed in the Temple of Dagon. So first of all, we should know a little bit about Dagon, right? Dagon was mentioned in Sefer Shoftim. Dagon was the place where Shimshon was killed. So that was a celebration to Dagon, right? Because the Plishtim thought that Dagon had given them the victory over Shimshon. So he's a Plishti god. He's more than a Plishti god, though. There's a place in Sefer Yehoshua that's named after Dagon because he's also a Canaanite god. And actually, he goes very far back. Apparently, they have like dedications from Sargon and Hammurabi to Dagon. Dagon is an ancient Middle Eastern god. And it doesn't just go far back, but the worship of Dagon lasts for a very long time, even after Sefer Shmuel. So you have this amazing thing here in Sefer Maccabim, right? Book of Maccabees. You know, we just finished Hanukkah. So you know that even though the rededication of the Beis HaMikdash happened in 160, the battles between the Hashmonaim and the Syrian Greeks and the Misyavenim and their allies lasts for a very long time, even after the liberation of Yerushalayim and the Nes of Hanukkah. So in chapter 10 here in the Book of Maccabees, you see right underneath the Psukim. So the book describes this battle. This is after Yehuda HaMakabi has been killed. So Yochanan and Shimon, right, two of the other sons of Matisyahu, are leading Klal Yisrael. And they're fighting a battle with the Syrian governor, right? Baruch Hashem, the Hashmonaim emerge victorious. The Syrian Greeks flee. And where do they run? They run to what they translate here as Azotus, which is Ashdod. They run to Ashdod, and where do they enter? Beth Dagon, right? So this is almost 1,000 years after Sefer Shmuel. You still have pagans in Ashdod. In the time of the Hanukkah story, there are pagans in Ashdod who are worshiping Dagon, right? Same place where the Plishtim brought the Aron to Ashdod. Hundreds of years later, it's a very tenacious form of worship, right? Now what happens, Yochanan wins, Bnei Yisrael conquer Ashdod. What they do, they burn the temple. And actually, the Book of Maccabees says this was politically risky because the Egyptian king later on comes over, and some of the Greeks there, you know, the Egyptians are also Greek at this time. They're all different empires from Alexander. So they try to get the Egyptian king on their side because they say, look at, you know, the Hashmonaim who burned the temple of Dagon, but it doesn't work out. The Egyptian doesn't really care. So it's politically risky, but Yochanan, on, you know, a point of principle, like we have the temple of Dagon, which we have in Sefer Shmuel already, you know, people are worshiping and they're defying the Aron Kodesh. So we have the opportunity to destroy this place. That's what we're going to do. But you see how ancient Dagon worship was, and how long-lasting it was, even, you know, long into the period of the second Beis HaMikdash, right? So that's just like important to have in mind. This is not just some random god. This is a central divinity for the local pagans, and it lasts the whole period of Bayis Rishon, even into Bayis Sheni. Now, there's a very interesting medrash which the Malbim quotes. Right here, a machlokas between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, right, who argue all the time. How to think of what the Plishtim did? Why did the Plishtim bring the Aron Kodesh into the temple of Dagon? So Medr says right here, says Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Shimon Lakish, they argue what's going on. Rabbi Yochanan Amar Kabdeu says, actually, they were honoring the Aron Kodesh. Amru ze eloka veze eloka. We have two gods over here. Yavo eloka v'yishreitz eloka. So we'll take one god and we'll place it next to the other one. After all, what did the Pasuk actually say? They placed the Aron next to Dagon, Eitzel Dagon. So argues Rabbi Yochanan, this is so interesting, that they actually put the Aron on the same level as Dagon. These are two gods. We'll put them both in our pantheon. Right? You go to the pantheon, you have, you know, Zeus and Athena, etc. We'll have Dagon and we'll have the Aron Kodesh, right? And in their mind, this was such a cover to the Aron. And that's the view of Rabbi Yochanan. Rish Lakish responds, as you know, this was he did for a living, was fighting with Rabbi Yochanan. Rish Lakish Amar, Kachai Bescharan. Says, wait a second. The Plishtim are going to get punished, and they're going to get punished severely. So if they were honoring the Aron, so why would Hashem react so harshly? Ela amru zen notzeach v'zen atzuach. This is not two equal powers, according to the Plishtim. Rather, they said, this is the victor, and this is the vanquished, right? Dagon won, Hashem lost. Yavo natzuach v'yis abed le'notzeach. Right? We're going to take the vanquished one, we're going to take the defeated Aron, and it will serve the victor. This is not replacing the Aron next to Dagon as a way of saying that, oh, these are two equal gods and we'll put them both in our pantheon. Not at all. Rish Lakish says the symbolism of the moment was we've captured the Aron, we've defeated HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he is going to be held prisoner in Dagon's temple. Those are the two views in Amram. Rish Lakish's view definitely, you know, is the easier one to understand. Like, his kasha seems pretty strong, doesn't it? Right? Why are the Plishtim going to get punished so severely if they think that that this is a god and this is a god? But what Rabbi Yochanan's probably going to answer is that's exactly the pathology of the mentality of Avodah Zarah, right? Okay, you know what? It's impressive that the Plishtim said that Hashem is on the same level as their divinity. Why is that impressive? They should realize they have Shev Mitzvahs B'nei Noach. They should realize that there is one God. The Plishtim, as we know from what they've said, you know, first of all, we know it from Az Yashir. We know it from what they said in Perek Dalet, and we'll see this coming up soon. The Plishtim are very, very well aware of the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, right? So they know what Hashem can do. They don't have any history of Dagon, you know, miraculously saving them from some other nation and having all these plagues. It's never happened. So Rish Lakish says, you know, that the Plishtim are being incredibly offensive because they dare claim that they've captured the Aron and defeated Ribono Shalom. Rabbi Yochanan says, to tell you the truth, even putting Hashem on the same level as Dagon is not something to be recognized, give them a pat on the back, you know, what do we expect? That's nice, positive intentions. Not at all. We expect them to recognize the power of Hashem, the overwhelming power of Hashem, the meaningless of their idol. Their failure to do so is absolutely fitting for the punishment that Hashem is going to bring. Very interesting debate between Riach and Rish Lakish. What would we expect of the Plishtim? What does Hashem expect of the Plishtim? And why does he react to them as he does? Now, coming back to the Psukim, so right, the Aron is there, and the Nabi describes what happened. So they come in the next morning and they see that the statue of Dagon has fallen in front of the Aron. Some of the Mepharshim point out not only did Dagon just, you know, fall over, someone might think that it's a gust of wind blew the statue over, but originally they were placed next to each other, right? It was Zeh Eitzel Zeh. Somehow, not only does Dagon fall, but he falls in front of the Aron, right? So in order to ascribe this to a chance wind, you're going to have to say that it blew over, and then it somehow rolled so that they came in the morning and they saw Dagon, you know, lying flat on his face right in front of the Aron, right? They should have realized that this was not a coincidence. But they don't. It's going to be a running theme in this whole couple of prakim, is it should be overwhelmingly obvious to the Plishtim what's happening, but they are stubbornly slow on the uptake. So they pick up Dagon, they put him back in his, you know, imagine his pedestal, right? Like a nice marble statue, little column with Dagon on the top, right? So they pick up Dagon, you know, give them a couple of kisses. You know, I don't know, maybe they fast that day. I don't know what the halacha is for the plishtim if their idol falls down. You know, if the local priest just has to fast half a day, whatever they do. So they pick up Dago and put him back on the pedestal. What happens the next morning? So they wake up, they come in the next morning. Once again, Dagon is prostrate on the ground. Right? Dagon's head and his two palms have somehow been amputated, and they are lying at the door frame of the temple. Rak Dagon Nishar Alav. You have this very cryptic line. Only Dagon remained on it. What? So let's try to figure out what's going on. At one level, right, if they didn't get the message when their idol toppled over and was lying prostrate in front of the Yaron, so now that's happening once again, except this time, right, the head of the statue and its hands have been cut off. We can appreciate the symbolism of that. We just said Hallel, for the whole 8 days of Hanukkah. Right, the symbolism of taking the eyes and the mouth and the nose and the hands, right, which we always mock Avodah Zarah, right? So those, that part has been severed and left cast aside by the doorframe. But what does the pasuk mean when it says only Dagon was left on it? It's a very cryptic phrase. So the Radak has a really fascinating explanation. Let's take a step back. What exactly is Dagon, right? So there are like two clear words that you might see in Dagon. One is, I think the historians mostly pick up on, is the word Dagon, grain, right? Because Dagon was a god of agriculture. This is going to be important. He's an agriculture god. He's a god of fertility. You also see the word Dag, right? So Rashi already says, there seems to be an association between Dagon and fish. Truth is, you know, fertility and fish go together, right? We think of our Simanim and Rosh Hashanah, right? Nifra v'nirbe kedagim. So, you know, Dagon's being associated with agriculture. It's being associated with fish. Let's remember the Plishtim live on the coast, right? They're the sea peoples. They're a sailing naval power. So Radak thinks also that Dagon was a fish god. And he suggests that the statue of Dagon was a merman, right? It says Dagon mitiburo ulmata, from the belly and below, hayatsuras dag. So it says he was half fish, half man. Lefikach nikra, that's a type of, that should be nikra Dagon. He's called Dagon. So, and then from the trunk and up, it was the body of a man. So says Radak, what exactly was happening? So when the Plishtim came in the morning, they saw their Dagon statue in three pieces. The head and the hands are over there by the threshold of the temple. The human trunk of the Dagon statue is lying prostrate in front of the Aron. And the bottom, the fish bottom of Dagon, that remains up on the pedestal. Right, so that's what the pasuk means when it says "Rak Dagon Nishar Alav." The fish part of Dagon is left on it. So if Radak is right, then what's the message that's being sent to the Plishtim? Right, what's your God who you venerate? Ultimately, your God you venerate is a fish. Right, it's just an animal. Is, you know, a theme we've seen before. We're gonna see again. The Plishtim, they worship and venerate the might of man, right? The glory of man. But ultimately, what they worship is an animalistic attitude, right? All physical power. Animalism, ultimately, is what the Plishti system of worship boils down to. So they come into the temple, says Radak, right? And the image is, you know, the human part of Dagon is split. The hands and the head are at the door frame. The human trunk is on the floor, and all that's left, you know, you can imagine, if you imagine the marble statue with a big, you know, Dagon plaque on it, you know, probably dedicated by the local wealthy Plishti, you know. So look, on top of the pedestal is just the tail of a fish. So that's the imagery that we get from the Radak, right? So by this point, that already should have been enough for the Plishtim to figure out what's going on. But it sounds like the Plishtim remain stubborn and they do not yet change course. So just background for a second, because what's going to happen is the Aron is going to be schlepped around from Plishti town to Plishti town. And the same thing's going to happen. It's going to come, there are going to be plagues, and then they're going to send it on its merry way. So let's load up the screen share again and look at the map from the Dat Mikra. It's very helpful just for visualizing the story for the whole parak, right? So you begin here, right here is Afek. So that's where the battle was in Perek Dalid. Evan HaEzer, that's the Jewish camp. If you recall, the Plishtim, after they win the battle, right? So the army is going to march all the way east into the very heartland of Eretz Yisrael. They're going to destroy Shiloh, destroy the Mishkan. And we should remember, the geopolitical situation now. The Plishtim are now going to extend their sovereignty over the whole heart of the country, right? This is going to be a devastating moment for Kal Yisrael. And then what do they do with the Aron? They bring the Aron back from the battle, back from Evan HaEzer, as the Parak said in the beginning, and they bring it to Ashdod. So here on the coast, you have the five main Plishti cities. There are five main cities: Ashdod, Ashkelon, Aza, Gat. Goliath is from Gat over here, and Ekron. Right, and then that's the end of the coastal plain. Then you get into the Shvela, right, the low-lying towns. So, for example, in Sefer Shoftim, Timna was originally a Jewish city. By the time you get to Shimshon, the Plishtim have taken over Timna. Right, Shimshon's first wife is from Timna. So the Plishtim are extending their way eastward. And over here you have Beit Shemesh. Beit Shemesh is going to play a major role in Perek Vav. And this is like the Jewish frontier, right? Now, the first Jewish town on the, closest to the coast is Beit Shemesh. So these are the five towns, the original five towns, right? The Plishti five towns. So they're going to take the Aron first to Ashdod, then they'll march it over to Gat, then they're going to march it over to Ekron, and then finally it's going to be brought back to Kal Yisrael. So what persuades the Plishtim to bring it back? So there's a plague. Now, it's not entirely clear what the plague is, but the Navi says, "Vatichbad yad Hashem al Ashdodim," and Hashem smote them heavily. "Vayach osam," and then you have a kriyuksiv, achilim or tchorim. The reason why it's probably a kriyuksiv is because the word that's written is offensive, right? It refers to some terrible sores in the bowel region. You don't want to say that out loud when you read the Haftorah, so that's why you always have the kri, you always have tchorim, which is the word that's used instead. It's not so clear what exactly this plague is that the Plishtim are suffering. I think the classic translation is hemorrhoids, but from what the Navi describes, it sounds like it was a much more graphic and much more lethal plague than just hemorrhoids. The Dat Mikra actually quotes Josephus, who says that it was dysentery, which makes a lot of sense because they have extremely inflamed bowels, right? Terrible diarrhea, the kind of stuff you'd frankly want to have a kriyuksiv for, because this is not the thing that you declare out loud when you read the Haftorah. And it can certainly be fatal. There's one other approach that some modern Mepharshim say now. They suggest maybe it's bubonic plague, because as we'll see, mice are going to be make an appearance, but that doesn't really seem to make any sense, because while bubonic plague does cause large sores like the ones which are being described here in the pasuk, these tchorim, those are not native only to the region of the bowel; they can appear in other places of the body as well. So whatever exactly is going on, it's not good, right? They're being stricken with severe illness. So all right, already, by the time Dagon fell over and Dagon got decapitated and everything, That was enough to give them the message. And now they have this devastating plague. So the people of Ashdod say, we want him out, right? Now, what should be the logical response? Send the Aron back to Eretz Yisrael. What do the Plishtim do instead? They send the Aron over to the next Plishti city. They send the Aron over to Gat, right? Why on earth would they do that? Probably because in the pagan mentality, gods have more power in some areas rather than in other areas. Right? Places in Tanakh where the Gaiim say, okay, Hashem, he's a mountain god, but he's not a plains god, right? So, okay, you know, Ashdod is an area where Hashem clearly, he won in Ashdod, but, you know, it's like tennis. So some tennis players are better on clay courts and some are better on grass courts. Okay, so Hashem be Dagon in Ashdod, but we'll bring him over to Gat and then he's not going to have any chance, right? Not defies rationality, but again and again, there's such a stubbornness to admit that Dagon is going to lose. So they bring the Aron to Gat. Sure enough, the same thing happens, right? This devastating plague. Okay, then they bring the Aron to Ekron, the third city. And as it gets to the outskirts of Ekron, so the people of Ekron say, absolutely not. We are not interested in this whatsoever. You are not bringing the Aron into my city. Lahamiseni v'asami, right? To slay me and my people. So the people are suffering terribly. And finally, Pasuk Yud Beis closes it out by telling us, right, that some people died, some people didn't die, but they're all in terrible pain from the plague. Batal shavasa ir hashamayim, right? And they're crying with up to shamayim. Okay, so that's the first major chunk of Parakeh. Plague, and on the one hand, and stubbornness to admit divine defeat on the other hand. Now, if we had to stop and think for a second, what does this remind us of, right? What phenomenon in Jewish history does this remind us of? So what would you think?
Paro.
Yeah, exactly, right? The connection to Paro and Mitzrayim jumps off the page, right? Plenty of people point this out.
Can I say something?
Sure, of course.
One of the problems here with Avodah Zarah, not a problem, but they were able to accept all kinds of gods, not just their god. And they didn't, I mean, we see that Kadosh Baruch Hu is supreme and can do anything. Their mindset wasn't quite that way. So they wouldn't see that the Aron representing Kadosh Baruch Hu could be strong everywhere because their gods weren't. So their mindset was so different than ours, so different than a modern mindset, Western modern mindset. It wouldn't even occur to them that it would be strong no matter what. The HaKadosh Baruch Hu would be strong no matter what.
Right. Okay. So I hear that. Right. The mentality of Avodah Zarah is just there's such a chasm between what they believe that you can understand why they behave the way they did, right? But you know, even so, I mean, if you knew about the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, and then you see it happening to you here in Ekron, I would have just sent the Aron back. I would have taken my chances by bringing the Aron to God, right? But
who says they knew the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim?
Ah, okay. So let's see, right?
Because the whole administration.
They did because when the Jews brought the Aron to the battle, the Plishtim said, "Oh, we're in big trouble because the God of the Jews who beat Egypt is here," right? So they're aware.
Okay.
Yeah,
I missed that point.
Yeah. Okay. So that's okay. Thanks. That's helpful. Right. So just to like briefly show, there are some literary points that's why I put in all the blue here, which are even copied in. Notice not only is it that you think of plague, and Hashem and not recognizing that Hashem is doing this or being slow on the uptake, but there are linguistic points as well. When over here in Shmuel, the pasuk talked about the hand of Hashem being on the Plishtim, right? And being heavy on the Plishtim. You have that as well, right? The Yad Hashem, the plague of Dever, right? The line where the Plishtim are saying, you know, me and my nation. So you have that here as well. This is Rabbanan Bazak from Haratzion points most of these out. Even the line where the people, right, their cry of the people went out to the city. So that reminds you of the two cries in the Shavuot story, right? First, before the Makos, when Bnei Yisrael cry out to Hashem. So you have a very, very similar phrase, right? Vayezaku batal shavasam el ha'elokim. That's, you know, at the beginning of the story. And then the bookend to the cry of the Jews in slavery is the cry of the Egyptians at the end of the 10th plague, right? Vayisat zaka gedola b'chol eretz Mitzrayim. Right, which was even greater, you know, than the Jewish cry. The Jewish cry in slavery was so great that it went up to Shemayim, but the suffering of the Egyptians by the end of the plagues was so great that, you know, there never has been anything like it. So you have a bunch of linguistic parallels. More are going to develop as we transition to Perek He, right? Which I'm not really sure why Perek Dalet and Perek Hey were divided at all, because it's all basically one story. So let's just run straight forward into it, right? Remember, what's happening now? The Aron, it's in no man's land, right? It was in Ashdod, and they sent it out. It was in Gat, hometown of Golias, they sent it out. It was sent over to Ekron. Ekron said, we don't want it. So what happens? So the Aron is in a field for 7 months, right? No, we don't know what to do. You can imagine there were probably different groups of Plishtim who wanted to do different things. So what do the people do? They ask the Kohanim and the Kosmim. So they ask the diviners and the priests, what should we do with the Aron? Right? They ask the Shiloh, right? Which again sounds reminiscent of Paro and the Chartumim, right? Paro had his magicians. And here the Plishtim ask their magicians what to do. And the Plishti priests and magicians tell them, if you're going to send it back, so don't send it back empty. You should also send it back with some gifts, right? Some atonement, asham, right? A guilt offering. And what they suggest is some golden sores in parallel to the plague of the sores. And also, this is interesting and important and new, 5 golden mice. Why golden mice? So here the Navi reveals something else, that besides the plague of whatever intestinal ailment they have that's devastating them physically, there also are mice which are destroying all of the produce of the land of the Plishtim. There are mice that are mashchisim es haaretz, right, which are destroying the land. That's very important for a couple of reasons, and symbolically. Number one, If Dagon is an agriculture god, so having a plague which is destroying the agriculture of the Plishtim is very, very symbolic, right? Just like some of the Mepharshim say that Makas Choshech was so important because the Egyptians worshipped the sun god, right? So we'll blot out the sun as the last step before Makas Bechoros. So not only does Hashem destroy the idol of Dagon, but he's also demonstrating that your agriculture god cannot protect your agriculture, right? And Hashem even does it through the most pathetic means possible, right? Mice, little mice. You guys, Dagon can't even protect you from mice. Now this line, Mashchis and Esa'aretz, is also a word which is lifted from the Makos, right? The Arov, Torah told us, Batishachis Haaretz, Mepnei Harov. So, but you know, there, whatever the swarm of Arav was, if it was insects, that's one thing. But if it was wild animals, you have swarms which are destroying the land. And here too, you have swarms of mice which are destroying the land. So the Plishtim are saying, the priests are saying, you're going to send it back with some gifts, send it back with some gold. You know, maybe the God of Israel will lighten up on you. And then this absolutely essential pasuk over here, this is like the clincher for thinking about Mitzrayim. Let's read it inside. Torah Navi says, "V'lama sechabdu es levavchem? Why should you harden your hearts? Kasher kibdu Mitzrayim uparo es libam." Just like the Egyptians and Paro hardened their hearts. Halo kasher hisalel bahem, right? Just like, you know, Hashem almost toyed with them, right, with the Egyptians. Vayishalchum vayeichu, right? What happened at the end of the Egypt story? They were stubborn, didn't work out, 10 plagues. Ultimately, the Jews left anyway, right? Paro sent the Jews out, and they left. So cut to the chase. Don't wait for 9 more plagues. We know how the story is going to end. Do not harden your hearts, right? Just send the Aron on its way. It's clear that there are different parties in the Plishtim. Some want to send it, some don't, right? They're arguing. The magicians say, send it back. Okay, so that's what they do. They're going to, but they're still not sure. So just one more point from the Pesukim over here. Right? There's like still resistance, even after all this, right? Even after the destruction of the idol and the plague and the mice. And they got the psak from their priests telling them, send the Aron back. So the priests say, you know, here's what we'll do. We'll set up a test. We're going to take 2 cows, which have never schlepped anything, right? Shtei paros olos asher lo ala lehem ol. So they have no idea how to pull a cart. We're going to attach them to the cart, and we're going to have their children behind them. So we'll see if the cows, who should by any instinct go to their children, do that. Or despite leaving their children and despite never having pulled a cart before, will they miraculously pull the cart towards Eretz Yisrael? That's the test that the Plishti priests propose. And that is what is done. Okay, so that's what happens. And, you know, long story short, the Aron, right, the nace happens, and the Aron is brought to the nearest Jewish town, which is Beit Shemesh. So if we stop and think for a second, right, so it's very nice. So the Navi has very carefully compared, you know, what's happening with the Aron to the Makos and Yetzias Mitzrayim. But when we think about what the meaning of that is, so we also need to think, what are the key differences between the two stories? And I think we can think of two, and they're both very instructive. One major difference is, what did we just see from the Plishti priests and magicians? What were they telling the people?
Right. They recognize HaKadosh Baruch Hu.
They recognize HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So it's so interesting. The opposite, of course, of the Chartumim, right? Paro's magicians who never, you know, who are stubborn until the bitter end, right? They never admit that they're wrong. Finally, you know, Shchin happened, you know, they slink away. But there is no point where the Chartumim are telling Paro, you know, give in. You know, it has to be Paro's servants who do that. So I wonder why the Navi has to tell us that, other than the fact that it's historically the case. So I think one reason might be, and, you know, we said last week that we were all done piling on the sons of Eli, but this might be one last point. This might be like the closing, you know, gut punch, is that the Navi called these priests, they were called the Kohanim. So the Kohanim of the Plishtim are the ones who recognize that they have to send the Aron back. It's like this bitter irony, right? The Kohanim of Bnei Yisrael were the total failure, right? They failed, and that's why the Aron gets to the land of Plishtim where it is. Chafni and Pinchas, who were supposed to represent Moshe and Aron, completely failed and ended up in the exact opposite accomplishment, right? Leading the people into captivity instead of out of captivity. And what really finally closes the circle on that is that it's the Plishti Kohanim who realize the overwhelmingly obvious that we need to send the Aron back. So that's maybe point number one. But point number two, I think the much more important one, is the key difference between the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim and what's happening over here is, well, let's put it this way, right? Another thing that this story shares in common with Yetzias Mitzrayim is that Hashem does not only bring plagues upon the land of Egypt and the people of Egypt. And Hashem also does destroy the Egyptian gods. But when does he do that? He does that at the very, very end, right? It's at Makas Bechoros where Hashem says, V'chol Elohei Mitzrayim e'aseh shifatim. So it's at the end of the process of the Makos in Egypt that the gods are destroyed. Here, first Hashem destroys Dagon, and only then does he proceed to attack the people and their livelihood, right? Why that difference? The reason is because the Hashem's goal and outcome are completely different. Because at the end of the day, the Aron is saved in these prakim. But who doesn't Hashem save? Who still is left under oppression? Kol Yisrael are under Plishti domination. Right? This should have been the moment, if we're thinking in terms of Yetzias Mitzrayim, so Hashem should destroy their gods, you know, devastate the people, and liberate Klal Yisrael from Plishti domination. But that very pointedly does not happen. Hashem only saves his Aron and leaves Bnei Yisrael under Plishti sovereignty. Right? So the whole focus of what Hashem does is only focused on the gods, right? There is such a chil Hashem here. You think that you've captured my Aron and thereby you have defeated me? So Hashem says, absolutely not. I'm going to step in and demonstrate my power over your God, right? First, I'm going to attack Dagon, and then if that's not enough to let you, you know, for you to let my Aron go, so then I'll attack the people to let my Aron go. But if Klal Yisrael want Geula, that's not going to happen by itself, right? That is going to require tshuva. And we have not seen that happen, that we've not seen that happen yet. So it's like the facsimile of the Yetzias Mitzrayim, but we don't get it twice, right? We do not get twice in a row just a freebie redemption. If we want Geula, we're going to have to do tshuva. And that is going to be Shmuel's job in Parag Zion, right? So yeah, on the one hand, such strong parallels to the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, but the major difference is that Hashem here is only saving the Aron. He is only undoing the Chilul Hashem that was caused by Chafni and Pinchas letting the Aron be captured and Klal Yisrael be defeated, but the people themselves are still in trouble, and the Plishtim are still running the show. So just to close out the parak, so the Plishtim, you know, they put the Aron on the wagon, with the golden mice and the golden sores, and the cows miraculously carry the Aron over to Jewish territory, right, to Beit Shemesh. The cows are lowing the whole time, right? Haluch v'ga'o, because they don't want to leave their calves behind, but right, they feel like compelled to carry the Aron to Beit Shemesh. And then we close with a very difficult and sad scene. Because what happens with the Jews of Beit Shemesh? The Nabi says that it was the harvest season. Beit Shemesh, kotzrim ketzir chitim. Which means, by the way, what time of year is it? What holiday are they celebrating if it's the harvest, if they're cutting the grain? What?
Is it Shavuos?
So it could be Shavuos. It's between Pesach and Shavuos, right? But it's between the Karban HaOmer and the Shtei HaLechem. So they're right. It's like you know, Pesach. It's Pesach season. You know, either you just celebrate, you're about to celebrate Pesach, or you just celebrate Pesach, and they're counting Sfira, right? But the whole story of Yetzias Mitzrayim to Matan Torah should definitely be, you know, in people's heads. So the Aron appears. People are happy to see the Aron. So they offer Karbanos. Right, the Levium take the Aron down, they put it on a big rock, those two cows which have brought the Aron, they offer as a carbon ola, very appropriate, right, they offer olos uzvachim, fine, all sounds very nice, the Sarane Plishtim, the lords or the tyrants of the Plishtim see this happening, they go home, okay, fine, all sounds very nice and good, right, and they lived happily ever after. Aron was brought back, Plishtim go home, the Jews have it, and we're good to go, right? Except that's actually not the case, because we have this major, we're thrown a major curveball in Pasuk Yates. Pasuk Yates, all of a sudden the Navi says, Vayach be'anshei Beit Shemesh, Hashem strikes the people of Beit Shemesh, Ki ra'u be'aron Hashem, because they gazed at Hashem's Aron. And then a very difficult line, Vayach be'an shiv'im ish, Hashem struck 70 people. 50,000 elefish, 50,000 people. Very hard to understand because there's no way there are 50,000 people in this little town of Beit Shemesh. So Rashi says what it means is he struck the 70 primary people, right? You think of a Sanhedrin. So Hashem struck the 70 leaders of the town, which felt to them like a loss of 50,000 people, and the people are devastated. It's Abu Ha'am, and they end up taking the Aron away to Kiryas Aron. Very, very strange. So, closing point, what happens? What do the people do wrong, right? I mean, you need to ask this on two levels. Like, what do they actually do wrong, and what was the spiritual flaw that led them to do what they did wrong that causes this such a twist of the conclusion that Bnei Yisrael are left in mourning when they should have been celebrating? So Rashi and Radak both comment, and I think that they're mutually supportive. Rashi says what's happening here is the people gazed at the Aron and they behaved with kalus rosh. Right? It was a frivolous celebration. They should have looked at it be'ema, right, with awe, but they didn't. Radak says not only were they, you know, Radak says it wasn't just a frivolous celebration. He says they got carried away. They were so ecstatic to have the Aron back. They were carried away with their celebration, so they ended up opening the Aron Kodesh to look what was inside. Okay, so right, you have Radak and Rashi both, you know, setting the scene. It's a frivolous celebration, says Rashi. Radak says, you know, it was too much. They were too excited to get the Aron back. But what's so interesting about this? What was the original mistake that Bnei Yisrael made, right? What got the Aron into this predicament for the first time? It was that they
were using the Aron.
Right. And they brought the Aron to the battle when they never should have. So in one sense, you can think of the Jews as, you know, being almost having too much veneration for the Aron, right? Ultimately, this is just a box, and you think that the box is going to save you, but that's not the case, right? Now, that would be kind of strange, because then over here, they go, it's like Mama Bear, Papa Bear, right? They go from having too much veneration, the box will save us, to here where they don't treat the box with enough kavod at all. So, you know, it's possible that they just went, you know, they tried to do tshuva and went from one extreme to the other. But maybe, you know, more likely, I think what's going on over here is the struggle clients shall have is, you know, how do we relate to the Aron and how do we relate to the Ribbono Shel Olam? The truth is, do they really venerate the Aron, or do they think of the Aron as a tool to further their own goals, right? We'll use the Aron and bring the Aron to battle to win for us, right? The attitude they had towards the Aron, like on the one sense, they venerated it, but really what it demonstrated was that ultimately they thought of themselves as superior to the Ribbono Shel Olam, right? We can force Hashem to do battle for us. They never actually had the Yira, which was required. That's the whole clash between the worldview of Chana and the worldview of Eli and Chatni and Pinchas. Whether we recognize Hashem Tzivakos, we'll come back to this again and again, because this is the theme in Sefer Shmuel, right? Do they recognize the overwhelming superiority of Hashem, or do they not? And the truth is, even though they venerated the box of the Aron and Perek Dalid, underneath it was a spiritual flaw. There was a lack of Yiras Shamayim in Perek Dalid, and that comes back to bite them in Perek Vav. When they're ecstatic to have the Aron back, they love the Aron, they've been desperate to get it back for months and months and months, the Ahava is there, but it needs to be joined with the Yira, and when that is missing, when you only have one and not the other, then you're just left with complete imbalance, right? So it was the same mistake in perspective which caused them to bring the Aron to the battle that now leads them to celebrate too much and even maybe open up the Aron, look inside when they get it, right? So we see, you know, even after Parakei and Vav, Klal Yisrael still have work to do spiritually. That's demonstrated by their inability to properly respond to the Aron. That's also demonstrated by the fact that Hashem has saved his Aron, right? We let the Aron go. but Hashem has not let his people go. So there still is a lot of work for Klal Yisrael to do. So that's what we'll pick up with next week. We get to Perek Zion, and we get to the tenure of Shmuel, and we'll see, you know, we know what he has to do, what his job is, and we'll see how well and to what degree he pulls it off. The answer is going to be, you know, Shmuel does good things for Klal Yisrael coming up next week. Okay.